Hi, I'm Simon Campbell.
And I'm Susie Starlight of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Welcome to the Supertone Show.
The Jimi Hendrix Experience and Purple Haze, the second single released on 17th of March in 1967, great year, on Track Records in the UK and on the 19th of June on Reprise Records in the USA. It peaked at number 3 in the UK and spent 14 weeks in the charts. Mm. It also featured as the opening track on his debut album, Are You Experienced, released on the 12th of May, where it was an immediate critical and commercial success, and it's widely regarded as one of the greatest debuts in the history of rock music.
Apart from Led Zeppelin 1, which was the greatest. But anyway, let's not worry about that.
Start as we mean to go on.
Indeed.
Sunshine.
Well, you know, Jimi Hendrix.
Yes.
I've really never liked his guitar playing.
I know.
Yeah. And the more I listen to him, though, I've got to say, I'm definitely, and I know it's crazy, the fact that I've been playing guitar for so long, but I'm sort of kind of warm into him because it, you know, and reading that Cream book that I'm reading right now is amazing because it talks about Hendrix, how explosive he was and what he did to the scene. He really changed the music scene in the UK. Absolutely, yeah. Totally, because he made it in the UK first. And the more I listen to it, and the other thing is my favourite producer of all time, Daniel Lanois, always listens to Hendrix. He says he always hears something new. And then I just heard something completely new, which I really hadn't picked up on before. And that was that slight talking in the background and the sort of stuff going on. Now, I know that Eddie Kramer didn't engineer this because he engineered the rest of a lot of the album, didn't he, when they went to Olympic Studios,
yeah,
to the rest of it, because this is the first track we've done at Delane Studios, this one. But it sounds to me as though that technique was used, i.e. moving, get the headphones, playing back to the headphones and moving them around the microphone. Because on that left, if you listen to it with cans, you can hear there's something very odd going, like talking and like a vocal, but very low in the mix on the left-hand side. And it's almost a bit, it's a bit sort of...
trippy.
Yeah, but also it's not just psychedelic. It's a bit sinister, you know, I think. But on that as well, you can't knock the guy, you know. I mean, it was an octave because he was using an octave. If you listen to that solo he was doing there, it was using an octave, which is a very primitive type of device based on a fuzz, which actually splits the signals and sends one an octave up. We have one made by Fulltone, and it's a great, very useful thing. And we use that on a number of our tracks in the past.
Yeah.
That octave thing. But anyway, that is something about the recording and Hendrix. But you are now going to tell me about Jimi Hendrix, aren't you? A lot more.
Well, it's funny, you know, because when you think of the 60s, he's up there, isn't he? But I still can't get over that he had to come all the way to the UK to make it, to actually really ignite that fire.
Yeah.
And September the 24th, 1966, the fateful day that Jimi Hendrix arrived in England.
Mm.
I think that's well cool. And the former bassist with the Animals, Chaz Chandler, he was leaving the band and he decided to manage Jimmy. And they formed a backing band with drummer Mitch Mitchell, who used to play with Georgie Fame and the Blue Flames. And they had bassist Noel Redding. And do you know what they say? He was chosen for his musical attitude and hairstyle.
And is it right that Mitch Mitchell, I think he did, because he actually played with Joe Meek, didn't he? If you remember, he started with Joe Meek and he fled the studio once, having his drums thrown at him or something like that.
Ah.
Or he thought that Joe Meek was a madman, you know, so there we are.
Oh, crikey, I think I remember that. Is that from that documentary that we saw as well?
I think it was.
Mm. Well, what happened with Jimmy as well, because I don't want to presume that when you listen to the show that you know everything about Jimi Hendrix, because I certainly don't. And so when we balance up, it's almost like, well, let's just have a look at what really went on, because this is what we're doing. We're looking at the year 1967. We're actually just looking at who was there and how it felt like, what the music felt like as well. So they were following the lead of Cream. And they were the Jimi Hendrix Experience, one of the first groups to popularise that kind of power trio format.
Mm.
Power trio. And obviously, you know, they talk about, you know, all these pedals, it's just really to modify his tone. It's just to kind of change the way he sound. And visually, the band set the trend in psychedelic clothes and haircuts, which I think is great.
That's right.
So what you don't always understand, though, when they first started playing, and they were like their early performances when they were like playing in London's The Bag O' Nails. Love that, The Bag O' Nails. Their early gigs were attended by people like the Beatles, members of the Rolling Stones, Jeff Beck, Eric Clapton, and Pete Townsend said, you know, like Jimmy, he changed the whole sound of electric guitar and turned the rock world upside down. And Eric Clapton said that after he went, because he went to see Jimi Hendrix Experience with Pete Townsend, he said, I thought that was it. The game was up for all of us. We may as well pack it in.
Well, he did have such an incredible impact. And I say, going back to this book, it really, because his clothes as well and his psychedelic and the whole thing, because he really changed. I think it was completely orchestrated by Chaz Chandler. I think he was a marvellous manager. And but what he did, he kept him away from a lot of engagements, really. He'd be put into situations, you know, and he'd be get to play a gig. He was really carefully managed in terms of his appearances and everything, you know. And I mean, Clapton freaked out. So did Jeff Beck, you know, when they saw him. Because I don't think it was the fact of his playing, because that's why I've never, I mean, you know, he's not that bad. He's one of the finest electric guitar players there ever been. You know, whether you like his style or not, it's different. But you can't take it away from that, that there's a madness in there. There's like the ferocity that you didn't actually get with the British acts.
Actually, and usually it's funny because it's the British usually have the attitude and the Americans are more smooth. And
exactly.
He turned that on its head, didn't he?
But I think coming over to England, I don't think it would have been recorded like that, because it was recorded on 4-track. And it's only when they went to Olympic that they managed mixed it on 8. And that's the amount of tracks that you've got to actually record. So, you know, you've got all these different instruments and you can only put them on a certain number of tracks. And then you have to bounce between, like the Beatles did. The Beatles did a lot of that in the other days. Now you've got a virtually unlimited number of tracks. But in those days, it was really tricky. But what it had a power. And the power comes from the distortion, because they were pushing the tape into distortion. They were pushing all the levels. And so much so, when they actually sent it to mastering, On the tape box, he wrote, "Deliberate distortion, do not correct." Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, Big Leg Emma, released as an A-side in 1967 on Verve Records. It was also the B-side to his other single released that year, Son of Susie Cream Cheese, which actually I could call my wife because you are a bit partial to a bit of cream cheese on crackers.
That's
right,
yeah.
And I will sometimes hear her sneaking downstairs in the middle of the night. Yeah, I can hear this crunching in bed.
Because I've got these like rice cakes that are really cool with them, you see. So I don't feel too guilty.
It's very, very funny. Yeah, you're guilty of indecision, but not in this case. Anyway.
Yeah.
You know, Frank Zappa, his first, you know, release, you know.
That year of the single. But, you know, yeah. Both singles failed to chart anywhere in the world.
Well, you can understand it because it's such unusual music. I mean, that's a 12-bar blues. But is there a comedic side to it? And every time that I listen to Frank Zappa, I always giggle. And this is, that's right. And he always retained that comedic, you know, attitude, even though his music became more and more complex. I mean, that is quite odd, but, you know, later on, when you hear Apostrophe and all that stuff, it was magnificent, and The Plane was absolutely magnificent, you know? And I think he described as an attempt to make dumb music to appeal to dumb teenagers, which I thought was very funny. If you've listened to the past two shows, you'll know that these shows are all based around 1967.
Yeah.
And, you know, we say every week the variety and quality of music that was produced in that year I think it surpasses any other year that's ever been in modern contemporary music. And I personally think that doing these shows, and I think we're going to carry on in 1967 until we run out of great tracks. It might take a few weeks, but
I think I've got another five, actually, shows.
Yeah, well, you know, and I think, personally, they're the most important shows that we've ever done. This is show 97 now. And
oh, my goodness, in three more.
I know. We'll have to have some sort of centenary show. That's right. We'll have to open some champagne on the air or whatever. Well, actually, here, because we're in Germany, we have this absolutely fantastic sparkling wine.
The Riesling here is
which is
delicious.
Based on Riesling, yeah, which is really delicious and extremely affordable as well. So anyway, let's go on to Frank Zappa.
Well, with Frank, you know, what I always think about Frank Zappa is Laurel Canyon. You can't help but think that the two go together. And he moved into Laurel Canyon in the year before, in 66, with his friend Pamela Zarubica. And that was when he was recording his first album called Freak Out. And because everyone knows, and if you don't know, his house was like the meeting and living place for many of the LA's musicians and groupies of the time. The fact that Frank did not like drugs, he didn't take them, he was clean, so he disapproved of it. But his house was like the place to hang out in. And then
he used to drink tea as well, didn't he? I don't think he didn't drink at all.
No, he was completely non.
Which is bizarre, because when you look at him and listen to his stuff, it sounds like there's some psychedelic drugs been involved.
He's
somewhere.
Got a natural high, you know, and I think that he probably didn't enjoy it because he's got enough of the natural stuff going on in his body that it didn't make him happy.
Unbelievable.
So, you know, good on Frank. So, well, this is a beautiful part of the story as well, that he met Adelaide Gail Sloatman.
Sloatman?
I know. Anyway, they fell in love within a couple of minutes of meeting each other. She moved into the house of the summer. They married in 1967, had four kids together and stayed together until he died.
Oh, great.
I know, it's quite, well,
it's beautiful, isn't it? I mean, it's beautiful. And the fact that he was, you know, he was a genius then. He's done so many records. And because his compositional style, you know, there was later on abrupt rhythmical change into songs that were built from diverse elements, you know. And his lyrics were really critical and a hypocrite, you know, a lot of hypocrisy, a lot of sarcasm, a lot of real incisive stuff. You know, and when you listen
aimed at the 60s counterculture, actually.
Amazing.
That's odd, isn't it?
Yeah, amazing. And this track was produced by a guy called Tom Wilson, who worked with Bob Dylan, Velvet Underground, Simon and Garfunkel. And a talent spotted the band and signed them to the Verb division of MGM, who were trying to diversify from jazz into rock and pop. Well, I bet they had a bit of a shock when they got this guy. You know, and this sort of really makes sense, because I saw an interview with Frank, a little clip. It's been around for a bit, actually, and I keep watching it every so often. I keep popping up on Facebook and stuff. And he was talking about what happened to the music business. And he was signed up by a guy with a big fat guy with a big cigar, and he said, well, I don't know what this is, but it doesn't matter, let's just put it out. And they put it out, and then eventually the hippies, or the people who were tastemakers, who thought were tastemakers, got into control, and they started to control, because they only started to sign and release what they thought was going to be cool. And if that had happened, you know, Frank Zappa may never had you know, reared his beautiful.
She would never say where she came from. Yesterday don't matter if it's gone. While the sun is bright, or in the darkest night, no one knows. She comes and goes. Question why she needs to be so free. She'll tell you it's the only way to be. She just can't be chained to a life where nothing's gained and nothing's lost. At such a cost. Still, I'm gonna miss you. There. was no time to lose, I heard her say. Catch your dreams before they slip away. Dying all the time. Lose your dreams and you will lose your mind. In life unkind.
It's not the Beatles. It's the Rolling Stones and Ruby Tuesday, released as the B-side to Let's Spend the Night Together. And that was released on the 14th of January 1967 on Decca Records in the UK and London Records in North America. Now, due to the controversial nature of the A-side's lyrics, namely, I'm off my head and my mouth's getting dry, I am high, but I try, etc., let's spend the night together kind of thing. Ruby Tuesday, the B-side, got more airplay and it ended up charting higher in both the UK and the US. And it topped the American Billboard Hot 100 chart and reached number 3 in the UK's record retailer chart. I struggled saying that then.
The record retailer exactly. chart, yes indeed. Sorry. You've got to watch those.
Oh no, it really got
what
me.
A week again.
So it was listed as a double A-side by then, but... There you go, 1967. But don't they sound, to me, that's their first exploration into psychedelia. And it sounds like they're just doing like a Beatles formula.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's a cross between the Beatles and the Moody Blues, I think.
Really?
Yeah, I think so.
You hear the Moodies, do you?
Yeah, because there's some cello in there. There's beautiful flute. Brian Jones at that time had stopped being the lead guitar player of the band.
Yeah.
And, you know, because, I mean, he was so messed up because he was really messed up on drugs. And he was playing a variety of other instruments. He played piano on that, I think, and you know, and like double bass. Keith Richard played the double bass with bowed strings.
I love the sound. You know, you know that sound. You can hear it. I love the sound of a bow.
Yeah, and
it's got a lovely, like a dronal texture, hasn't it?
Yeah, and you know, this always stands out to me. It's like, they're alternatives to rock and roll. They're alternatives for R&B because you always think that the Rolling Stones are an R&B outfit. You know, Let's Spend the Night Together, Satisfaction, you know, all those great R&B songs. And then, you know, they come up with something like this, which is Baroque pop. That's what they call it, isn't it? It's that sort of, yeah. And
not proto-punk pop,
no,
but Baroque.
No, no, no. Fortunately, there's no proto involved in this.
No, but, I had to say it though because I like saying it, yeah.
Yeah, but, you know, but there was a recorder on there as well.
Yeah, I could have done that as my first instrument.
And, you know, tambourine. But it really is great. And, you know, it really illustrates that Mick Jagger can't sing.
Well, I was going to say, you know, the way, you know, the way he was singing and he was trying to be tender, it kind of, it was awkward, like a schoolboy like with knobbly kneecaps.
Yeah, I'm joking. I mean, he's an amazing vocalist. Not a singer, but
he wasn't a crooner, though.
No, definitely not.
No.
But, you know, it's a different side to the Stones, which is quite beautiful and shows them the great songwriters. You know, Richards and Jagger, great.
Story, this, though.
All right. Go on.
Keith Richards wrote it, even though, you know, it's always Richards and Jagger when it comes to the copyright and stuff. But
yeah, McCartney and Lennon, wasn't
it? Yeah,
same kind
of writing partnership. So Keith Richards wrote the song about his girlfriend at the time called Linda Keith. Now, Linda had left him for Jimi Hendrix.
No.
Yeah.
Holy moly.
And she got involved with drugs. So he tried to get her back, and eventually, because he thought that, you know, she wasn't in a good way, he went to see her parents and told them she was going down a dark path.
This is Keith Richard, okay.
Yeah, I know, right? So Linda's father went to New York to find her, and she was made a ward of court.
No.
Yeah. And then because, and Linda thought basically that Keith had betrayed her, and they didn't speak again for years because of that.
Wow.
Isn't that funny? So it changes everything when you know what the story about a real person is, something that really happened.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. I don't care how much money I gotta spend. Got to get back to my baby again. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. When she wrote me a letter, said she couldn't live without me no more. Listen, mister, can't you see I got to get back to my baby once more. Anyway, yeah, give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. When she wrote me a letter, said she couldn't live without me no more. Listen, mister, can't you see I got to get back to my baby once more. Anyway, yeah, give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter. My baby just wrote me a letter.
Sounds like apostrophe that at the end with that wind blowing. It's not, though. It's the Box Tops. The Letter released a single in August 1967 on the Marla record label, who had Link Rayon, Spooky Tooth, etc. Now,
yes,
this is under 2 minutes long, and it's a beautiful pop song. It's a great song. You know, it's got everything about a great pop song, great chorus, you know. And the interesting thing is that in the 60s, they always had this thing where they, well, not always, but a lot of tracks, they had this, like, minor verse. Give me a ticket for now. And then all it comes joyous in the chorus. She wrote me, you know, like, a, yeah, which, you know, a in the major takes up to the
happy.
The major, that's right.
Feel.
And but it's a great song. And it's very unusual because here, the drummer was told not to do anything too busy because the bass player was playing some real hot. That's like Susie Starlight, hot stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And right, when you're actually producing a record, or when you're an artist and you're recording and you do it yourself, there's a tremendous problem with the rhythm section. And I say tremendous problem. If they're a great rhythm section, they both understand what they're doing. But, you know, sometimes you get a situation where the drummer and the bass player are not sort of playing together, not listening to each other, you know.
They're both too busy.
Yeah,
they're not actually becoming, they're not part of the same engine.
Exactly. And then you listen to someone like Cream or Free, you know, where everything is perfectly in its right place. Cream is chaotic.
It is,
but
as well.
But it's kind of all together because the bass and the drums are sort of melded into one mess of rhythm and melody.
Mm.
And then the guitar sort of just stuck on top, you know, and it's amazing. But anyway, that's the
I thought I put, well, I'm so glad you read that out, you know, because I giggled to myself when I put those notes down, because I thought, yeah, you know, it's true. If you've got this, if the bass line's doing something really creative and there's lots of movement in it, then, you know, the drummer can just, like, hand back and do, like, straight four on the floor kind of thing and just keep it simple because he's serving the song. And that's what I love about music, is, like, you're a team. So when somebody's, like, with Cream, you can have three of them all busy all the time, and they do. It's almost like, you know, they're just speeding and you know, down the salt flats at Bonneville. They just go bang. And there are other times when you can have, like, the drummer doing some stuff and then the bass. You know, I can't tell you how joy as it is for me just to keep a nice simple groove going. I get just as much joy as that as I do when I'm, you know,
well,
doing a bit of a...
Yeah, you see, you might do,
I like both.
You might do simple grooves, but they sort of fit, you know, with the drums. And it's really interesting because, you know, you listen to now Rodgers, when he was working with Cheek, and Tony Thompson turned up, was a great drummer, and he stole his tom-toms. And he said, "You won't be needing any of those."
Yeah, yeah.
And he just had basically a kick drum, hi-hat, and snare drum, and some stuff, and that was it.
Yeah, yeah.
Because Bernard Edwards was the man in that band. It sort of, and the guitar was so funky, there wasn't any room for something that was tricky on in the drums, you know.
Because you're trying to get the feel. It's the overall picture, isn't it? And it's like, and that's the other thing, you know. It's like all the band, they're in. They're part of a bigger picture. It's not just an individual thing. But this song, I've got to confess, right? I'd never heard it.
No.
And I'd never heard of the Box Tops.
Yeah, the Box Tops are one of those bands because
from Memphis, you know?
Yeah.
And I didn't know. They were first called the DeVilles, but then they had to change their name because there was a band called the DeVilles in New York. But the lead singer, Alex Chilton, was 16 years old when he recorded this track. But just to put this into context as well, right? This song was a major international hit in the September of 1967. It reached number one on the Billboard Hot 100 charts. It stayed there for like 4 weeks.
Wow.
It was ranked the number two song for the whole of 1967. It sold over 4 million copies. It's received 2 Grammy Award nominations, a gold disc. It was number one in Canada, number five in the UK. It's in the Rock and Roll, Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And it's added to the list of the 500 songs that shaped rock and roll.
Thank you.
at first just go sleep. Turn the wider shade off.
The mighty Procol Harum and A Whiter Shade of Pale. That was their debut single. Their debut single. And it was released on the 12th of May in 1967 on Derham Records. Their debut single.
Well.
Unbelievable.
Number one.
I sound like you. But it is. It is unbelievable.
Number one for 6 weeks in the UK singles charts with hardly any promotion. Reached number five on the Billboard Hot 100 charts in the United States. And one of the anthems of the Summer of Love. One of the best-selling singles in history, having sold more than 10 million copies worldwide, and my pick of 1967. And that's everything taken into consideration, and that is a big thing.
Wow.
I've got it on single. Of course, I was too young to buy it, you know, for starting. I was only, you know, pretty young then. But it is just everything to me. And I love Gary Brooker's voice. And what I do like about him, I mean, I've heard a lot of stories because a lot of our friends sort of know him or know of him. And, you know, it apparently he's a great guy, but he can still do it. I mean, there's a video of them playing outside. I think it's in Sweden. It's a big outdoor in front of some sort of stately home or something. And his voice is still magnificent.
We got goosebumps, didn't we, just watching it?
Yeah.
It was just like, it just so emotional, so, so beautiful.
And I saw him also do it on Jules Holland some years ago, and he's still the voice, you know. And the funny thing is that you always imagine Gary Brooker playing the organ on that, but he doesn't. It's Matthew Fisher, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah.
And there was a big hoo-ha about who wrote it. Matthew Fisher, in, I think it was 2005, something, got awarded 50% or 40%.
40%
of the royalties, ongoing from there, because it is all about, really, that keyboard, that Hammond inspired, but interestingly as well, that Hammond is not a C3 or a B3. Now, anybody knows about Hammond organs, everybody talks about the B3 and the C3, which, you know, Keith Emerson used, and all the big keyboard players, you know, Booker T, everybody basically used B3s and C3s. But this is done in an M100, like ours.
Yeah, we have an M100
in our studio here, an M100, and you know, it just
funny, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's absolutely incredible.
But it's the sound.
It is, and the whole thing, and the sound of the. I love, because apparently, what was it about the cymbals? He was saying that they thought Denny Cordell, who produced it, was concerned that it might prove problematic on the radio because of the prominence of the cymbals, and you know,
so he sent an acetate to Radio London to check to see what they thought about it. Yeah, and the DJ played it, and he just said, "Well, that sounds like a massive hit."
Yeah,
that's well cool though. I mean, but it's funny, isn't it? This song is iconic. Mm. Anyone's ever heard it, I think everyone knows this song. And if you don't, then I'm so glad that you've heard it on the show first. But I'm so emotional. I can't really say much more, really. But Keith Reid apparently got the title and the starting point from the song because he overheard someone at a party saying to a woman, you've turned a whiter shade of pale.
Is that right?
Yeah, so it was actually something that happened. And that's what happens a lot of the time. But if, do you know, with Gary as well, when he sings, he doesn't overperform. He tells a story.
Mm.
And that's what I think I really connect with him. He doesn't croon. He sings. He just sings it like Scott Walker doesn't put ego into his vocals. Mm. He just sings it as an instrument.
Yeah.
I feel that with Gary Brooker. I feel that he's very honest, very open. And he doesn't over-emotionalise stuff. He lets the whole band and the whole sound move you.
Well, of course, Matthew Fisher no longer plays with Brooker. Doesn't play with him for years because of all this dispute and hoo-ha.
Yeah.
And the incredible thing is that their keyboard player, who's been working with him now for about 15 years, a guy called Josh Phillips.
Yes.
Who is now working with us. And he's playing Hammond and Wurlitzer at our gig at the Met in Bury on the 15th of November 2019. Super plug, 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 plug. And also some other shows later on in the year and early next year.
It's very exciting.
We are unbelievably excited about that. You know, because when you see, you know, in playing it and you hear that iconic song, you know, and we've actually got a member of Procol Harum actually playing with us, it's a absolutely sensational thing, because he's a full member of the band. It is truly amazing. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, we just bumble through, don't we? You know, we write stuff, and we are quite strategic about the way we put songs out. And
well, you have to be. You have to have a level of business sense. But there's the point where, with us as musicians, where we're like 3-year-olds, aren't we? We're like kids.
Yeah, we sort of just bumble through, and all of a sudden, we're like, oh, right, well, we need a keyboard player, because Johnny's working with Johnny Henderson, who's a normal keyboard player. He's working a lot with Matt at the moment on big tours and stuff. So we needed somebody for November, and I just thought, oh, why don't we contact Josh? And I contacted Josh, and he said yes. And I said, wow.
Well, I am superstitious. Black cat just crossed my trail. Well, I am superstitious. Black cat just crossed my trail. I just might get put in jail. When my right hand is him, I get money for sure. When my right hand is him, I get money for sure. When my left eye jump in, somebody gotta go. Oh, the dog down the howl, the whole way down in the neighborhood. Well, the dog down the howl, I said the whole. Gotta go do some back and forth.
Savoy Brown, Ain't Superstitious, the opening track from the debut album, released in September 1967 on the Decord record label under the name the Savoy Blues Band. The album was never issued in the US, but was easily available as an import and produced by the legendary
Mike Vernon.
Again, Gus Dungeon was engineering, was the team. Amazing stuff, because this album was an album of covers, wasn't it?
Yeah.
Really? So, yeah. You know. And he, you know, they are a band which are sort of synonymous with that British blues thing that was going on
at
the time.
Can I confess here? I'd never heard of them either. Seriously, I didn't know. I hadn't heard of them.
Yeah, because it was kind of under the radar a little bit, really.
And it's not just respect to the music. It's just that you sometimes you just don't pick up on people. I mean, wasn't around then.
But it weren't 10 years after. They weren't, you know, they weren't Fleetwood Mac. They weren't doing that sort of thing, you know. They weren't John Mayall. But what I didn't know is that Martin Stone, who's a leading rhythm guitar player.
Right.
He was also a book dealer and later on went to work with one of my favourite fantasy authors, and that was Michael Moorcock, who I read all of his paperbacks when I was younger. Unfortunately, I sent them all to a charity shop, but so I haven't got them anymore. But there's, you know, so I read an awful lot of Michael Moorcock, and that's very interesting. So there we are, a little bit about...
They were formed in Battersea as well, Savoy Brang.
Ah.
Now, I know we're going to meet them in January because they're headlining, aren't they? The Skegness Great British Rock and Blues Festival in the UK.
And we are playing on the Saturday.
I know, this is weird, you know. This is the second time in the show that we're actually connecting in physically, like in real life with our
Josh
music.
Might be playing with us from Purple Harem, but don't mention it to anybody, okay?
Anyway, okay. So when you talk about this song, so this is Ain't Superstitious, yeah? Great kind of feel, a blues feel. And they really were. They started off as this blues band. And within 4 years, when they formed in London, they became like a major league live act in America, because at home in Britain, they weren't so lucky. And they never really broke out of the club scene, which kind of explains why they hadn't come on my radar, if you know what I mean. And critics sometimes say that one of the reasons maybe is because they had such a high turnover of people in the band, and there's so many lineup changes that they kind of got noted for like more of the ensembles that they had and the people that were in the band, and they never really weren't in the band long enough to really, you know, push it through.
Yeah, I know what you mean. It's because it's sort of just, it's like a football team, isn't it, really? You know, you've got to get a team together that's actually working together and then going for it, you know?
I think it's different with us, you know. I mean, because we write the music, you and I, and I can see that, you know, and I'm half the rhythm, and you can kind of see we are really open to working with other musicians because we have the sound, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, that's right.
And it doesn't take away too much from that, but you can kind of see if there's too many people changes, then people going, well, who are you? And I've got a lovely, lovely story of when they had their big break, okay. They landed a gig to play during the interval for Cream's appearance at Klook's Clique R&B Club at the Railway Hotel on the 2nd of August, right? Now, Klook's Clique, you wonder what that is. So I've just had a look. It was next to Decca Records. And it was run by two chaps, Jeff Williams and Dick Jordan, when they opened the club. And I think it ran for about 9 years, right? So back in the day, rent was just £5 a night, right? So they hired the venue from the Railway Hotel, and all they needed was a bottle of whiskey to give to the police to get them off their backs if the neighbours complained.
There's something happening here. What it is ain't exactly clear. There's a man with a gun over there telling me I got to beware. I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Battle lines being drawn. Nobody's right if everybody's wrong. Young people speak in their minds are getting so much resistance from behind. Time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Thank you. What a field day for the heat. A thousand people in the street, singing songs and a carrying signs, mostly say hooray for our side. It's time we stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Paranoia strikes deep into your life, it will creep. It starts when you're always afraid. Step out of line, the man come and take you away. We better stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. Stop. Hey, what's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop now. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down. We better stop. What's that sound?
You're listening to the Supertone Show with Susie Starlight and Simon Campbell of the Starlight Campbell Band.
Thank you, darling. It's lovely that you do that for a change. And that was a track by, I know, I'm smiling, Buffalo Springfield, and a track called For What It's Worth from their eponymous debut album. And now, we've included it in the show because it was released as a second pressing on the 6th of March in 1967 on the ATCO record label. It was written really at the end of 66 and released as a single, went huge. And then when they did a second pressing of the album, their debut album, they actually put that as the first track in the March.
Yeah, which is magnificent.
Yeah.
And so they should.
Wow.
Yeah, it's you know, ATCO label, owned, of course, by
Atlantic. Sounds like Acme, but it's
yeah,
not.
Yeah, it does, yeah, you know. And it was, every time I listen to that, I'm astounded by the production, because it sounds great. When it starts off, you talk about a rhythm section, it's just beautiful. The recording is sensational. It just is beautiful. And Stephen Stills is one of the, I think, I don't know, is he an unsung hero? He's a many sung hero, but he's like, he's not classed right up there. And he should be, you know, because
yeah,
he's a magnificent songwriter, an incredible musician, because he plays everything. He plays Hammond. I've seen him playing Hammond. That thing when he was doing the that session with Tom Jones.
I was going to say, not the, are you talking about the one with Tom Jones?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, and he's playing Hammond. And they're all, you know, Neil Young looks like he's got a face like a smack behind.
Yeah.
But of course, on this, Neil Young was on it and he was playing guitar, and those harmonics are very, very symbolic of this particular song. And it was written in response to a protest that had turned up into a riot in Sunset Strip in LA.
Yeah, because the adults were complaining about all the young people on the street.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's absolutely incredible. Nothing changes, of course.
Yeah.
And it was the song was performed on Thanksgiving night in 66, the Whiskey A Go Go, recorded within the next few days. And then, of course, it got released and released.
Well, it's topical, isn't it? I mean, that in those days, you responded to life events. And I think that's the one thing, you know. You do see it now a little bit more. What's the name of that young lady now who does the environmental? Greta.
That's right. Yeah,
and she wrote. She's part now with. There's a song with the 1975.
Yeah,
yeah. And you kind of, and I kind of like that too. I really like the fact that with this song, he saw something, went, oh my God, I need to write about this. And in those days, this is kind of how people connected,
protested,
wasn't it, really?
Yeah, it was like the Bob Dylan, you know, times that are changing, all those things. I mean, that was the early 60s, but it's definitely the age of protest and people actually listening to the lyric and actually
responding. When music had value.
Indeed. Now, you know, it is very, very difficult to penetrate into that psyche, you know, of people, which is very, very sad, because, you know, music is a great way of protest. It's a great way to air your grievances.
I always say sometimes, yeah, it's like, you know, if I can't say something, if I tried to say something to you, say in a pub over a nice glass of red, it wouldn't, I could offend you, or it could be difficult. But if I told you the same story in a song, it's a way of getting to connect with you without you feeling threatened, or
yeah,
we can meet together. Music's like a matchmaker of people, isn't it, really?
Totally. And you know, Neil Young, when he was in, I mean, it was a very stormy relationship, but before Strings, it's always been so. Anytime Neil Young is not in complete control of his music, there's always bother, isn't there? Like, you know, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young, it was like chaos all the time, and you know.
Well, you know how they got the name of Buffalo Springfield?
Go on.
It was after a company called the Buffalo Springfield Steamroller Company.
No.
Which kind of says it all, really, doesn't it? But I need to tell you this backstory because I was quite fascinated by this. So while I was in Toronto in early 66, Neil Young met Canadian Bruce Palmer. He was playing bass for the Minor Birds, yeah?
Okay.
And they needed a lead guitarist, so Neil joined the band. And the Minor Birds were set to record an album for Motown Records, but the singer, Ricky James, was tracked down and arrested by the US Navy because he'd gone AWOL.
Blimey.
And they didn't know. Mm. So they lost their record deal. So Neil and Bruce pawned all the Minor Birds' musical equipment and bought a 1953 Pontiac hearse.
Who wouldn't?
Called Mortimer Hearseburg, or Mort for short. I know, I love it so much, right? And then they drove to LA. Now, they drove to LA because they'd heard that Stephen Stills, they were trying to track him down, and they heard that he'd moved to LA. So they drove in this hearse to LA to try and find him. Spent a week trying to find him, and they thought, sack it, we just can't find him. They hung out in all the bars and everything. And so they were just on their way out of town, heading north towards San Francisco. And Stephen Stills and Richie Furay were heading down the other direction in Sunset Strip, and they spotted Mortimer Hearseburg.
No.
And so they managed to do a U-ey, and they pulled over, and that's how they got together. And this is kind of how it all started.
Well, that's the end of our show on 1967.
For this week, anyway. Come and join us again next week. We'll have more songs from the 60s, 67 in particular. We're going to play you out with a track by Jefferson Airplane called White Rabbit. And that's from their second studio album.
Watch called, those ears.
Exactly. Surrealistic Pillow. Now, this album was one of the quintessential works of early psychedelic rock in 1960s counterculture. And the first blockbuster psychedelic album by a band from San Francisco. Really important. Written by Gray Slick as a slap to parents who read their children novels like Alice in Wonderland and then wondered why their children later used drugs. It's funny, isn't it? I thought that was very funny. White Rabbit became one of the first songs to sneak drug references past censors on the radio. So for Gray Slick, White Rabbit is about following your curiosity.